Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Scott Kirzner. The 1960s and 70s saw a major migration of big companies leaving cities for suburban office parks. That's the era when General Electric left Schenectady, New York, for Fairfield, Connecticut, with its low-lying buildings, easy parking, and manicured lawns. But as early as this summer, GE will start packing up for its move to Boston.
According to Fortune, in 2015, only one of the top 10 companies on the magazine's Fortune 500 list had its headquarters in the downtown of a major city. Now, GE's move to Boston will obviously change that.
So does this represent a bigger shift in how companies think and operate? And what does a business get from being in a city center? Joining us now is Richard Florida, director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto, a professor at NYU's School of Professional Studies, and a senior editor at The Atlantic. He's also the author of The Rise of the Creative Class, among other books. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
So you think, and you've written a lot about how cities change as industries change, and in many ways, we'd say Boston has a lot of people in the creative class. So what was your first reaction to the news that General Electric is going to move its headquarters here?
Well, I think the driving factors in this are pretty clear, and they're the ones I identified way back over a decade ago in Rise of the Creative Class. The first is to be around talent and talented people, engineering talent, technical talent, managerial talent. In fact, the thing that stimulated my writing that book was when a high-tech company from Carnegie Mellon, where I was teaching at the time, picked up its roots. It was a startup from that company in Pittsburgh and moved to Boston. And in the words of its founders and the venture capitalists that invest in it, to be around the talented people that they were already in Boston and they would have to lure to Pittsburgh. So that's one. Second is obviously the great universities, MIT in particular. As a technical university, GE wants to be considered back to its roots, Thomas Edison roots, as a very innovative high-tech company. And, of course, the general quality of place. You know, I don't think of it as quality of life, but quality of place of the Boston region. I think in addition to that, you know, if I would think of competitors, the thing that struck me is, well, why not New York? New York City, NBC is there, where 30 Rock or General Electric has a major investment. And I think part of that reason is probably that housing costs have become so unaffordable and traffic congestion is so bad that Boston was seen as a great alternative that offered talent, universities, technology, quality of life. And although Boston is way expensive, Boston has more than 40% of its workforce in the creative class, one of the highest amounts in the country. So I think all of those factors, and I think the GE move signals a bigger move, and that is companies giving up the suburbs, you know, which is exactly where GE headed, as you said in your introductory remarks, moving away from the suburbs because talented and creative people, the kinds of people they need to hire, want to be in vibrant cities just like Boston.
Well, Richard, can I just jump in here? Because I have a quick question about exactly that. I mean, the move in the 60s and 70s, as Scott was talking about earlier, out to suburban office parks allowed companies to build these sprawling campuses that could have, you know, thousands possibly of employees all working together roughly under one roof for the same company. I'm wondering if cities now hold a greater attraction because companies, or maybe some companies have figured out that it's not so much their own employees talking to each other, but their employees having access outside the silos of the corporation itself and with other companies, other industries, easier in the city.
Universities and great university laboratories and access to all of that talent. I think the idea in the 60s was, you know, affluent people, the middle class, was moving out to the suburbs. And the word I like for this, you know, if you think about the great Route 128 beltway around the city, the companies and the high-tech engineers were moving to nerdistan, where they could drive their hopped up, you know, cars, whether that was a Corvette or a Porsche. They could park in the parking lot. But I think that fit with an era in which, you know, most people were married with families and children. Today, more than half of us are single or divorced. We're a solo nation, in the words of some. But also people switch jobs more. They move around. So companies have to replenish their workforce. A GE worker is no longer a worker for life, you know? So I think in order to get that range of employees, men and women, married and single, straight and gay, you have to be in a vibrant metropolis. And I think Boston is in a real sweet spot. You know, it's on the Eastern Seaboard. It has great access, not only to New York, or to Washington if you're commuting there to lobby the Congress if you're an executive, but also to Europe. It has a great international airport. It has great technology. And as I said, it has an affordability that, while expensive by dint of the rest of the country, still is a place a younger person. You don't have to be a CEO to be able to live in the greater Boston area, mm-hmm. or perhaps in New York now. You can't even be a CEO. You have to be an oligarch to be able to afford an apartment there. So I think all of those factors bode well for Boston.
So now, Richard, you wrote a really interesting blog post recently about the way transportation infrastructure actually is connected to innovation, and specifically the number of patents. There was some interesting research on that. So let's talk about transportation for just a second. The city of Boston is not without its MBTA woes and questions about whether we're going to have enough money to fund an extension. So is GE basically betting on our transportation infrastructure continuing to get better, at least not getting worse? What do you think? Go ahead.
I think your point about transit and transportation is spot on. You know, at my institute at the University of Toronto, not a single young person, postdoctoral researcher I employ owns a car. Now, think about that. When I was growing up, all you wanted to do was buy a car and escape your parents' home. So not a single person in my employ owns a car. So that means many General Electric employees, the ones my age, will probably want to have a car, but many don't want to own cars. They want to take transit. And certainly Boston and the MBTA have their woes, but compared to just about every place else on the planet or in the United States, Boston has a marvelous transportation system. Also, Boston is a compact metropolis. It has great urban neighborhoods. People can cycle to work if they like. Some people can live close enough to work so that they can walk. So I think the transit infrastructure of Boston was certainly a very big plus in luring GE, only because I think they're quite aware that younger employees and the following generations of employees are not going to want to have to commute in terrible traffic and congestion. Now, and again, what Boston offers is the fact that if you want to use transit, you can. If you want to bike, you can. If you want to live close, you can. And if you want to own a car and live out in your burbs, you can. So I think in that sense, GE has all of its bases covered.
Richard, can I just jump in here for a second? Because we're gonna run out of time here with you. I want to inject a little note of skepticism here, because on the one hand, I mean, yeah, it's great news that GE is moving to Boston. But on the other hand, it's news because it's so rare. I mean, I don't actually see a flood of, you know, Fortune 100 companies all of a sudden saying, we want to move to the middle of the city.
I agree. I would have predicted New York City, if you ask me, you know, that knowing the CEO structure of GE, its other clients. But I think it's a good thing. It indicates that places like Boston, and I think Washington, D.C. would be another one can play. My note of skepticism is different. I think the incentives are outrageous. I don't think they need what I read in the paper, the Globe covered this wonderfully, $145 million in incentive for a company that would have located in Boston anywhere. And when you look at the announced 800 jobs, that's $181,000 in jobs. You know, there's a lot of people in Boston that are struggling. There's a lot of kids in school that need school lunches. There's a lot of homeless people that need support, a lot of poor families and single moms. $181,000 a job, that's an outrage. And what I would encourage the people of Boston to do is to tell the mayor and the governor, we'd like to welcome GE, but say no to the incentives.
Well,
it's
Richard,
not like GE's going to move. They picked Boston.
Richard, we are out of time, but let me just ask you one quick follow-up on that.
Okay.
So how do you get cities and states to stop offering these incentives? I mean, if we didn't do it, New York was offering them more incentives. I'm sure Atlanta and Providence would have offered more incentives. So do you just have a moratorium where every state says we're not going to do it anymore?
It's time for a moratorium. It's time for the president to step up and say this violates the federal fair trade, and to step up and say no. But I think it's time for the people of Boston to say, we'd love to have General Electric, but we don't want to pay this corporate welfare. And I don't think they're going to go anywhere else. I think they made their choice. They're happy with their choice. They're taking a little extra cash off the table. And you know what? Just one last thing. When you look at the data, GE is one of the biggest recipients of corporate welfare in the country. They're one of the top 10 companies to take corporate subsidies like this. It's time to say enough is enough. GE, you're a great company. We love you. We want you here. and let's do it on your own dime.
Richard Florida is director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His latest book is Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Well, in a minute or two, we're going to talk more about GE's evolution as a business and where it's going. But first, we want to check in on one of the places GE is actually leaving. And that's Avon, Massachusetts, where the company is closing a valve factory this year and laying off more than 300 workers.
A little earlier today, I spoke with Henry Pyres. He's a stock clerk at GE in Avon, where he's worked for 27 years. Pyres is also the president of United Auto Workers Local 470, which represents about half of the employees there. And we asked him what he was going to do after the plant closes.
I have no idea what I'm going to do. And that's most of my members and even the other people that I know. We don't know where we're going, what we're doing. My membership, there's 54 of them that are over 50 years old, too old to start again, too young to retire. The other rest of my members, they're young, they're just starting out, young families with their kids and their mortgages, and they don't know what they're going to do.
What did you think yesterday when you heard that GE is going to move its corporate headquarters from Connecticut to Boston?
Well, my first thought was the poor workers in Connecticut. They're going to go through the same thing we're going through. It hurts me to know that my tax money is being an incentive to take jobs from someplace else.
And, you know, GE has a long history in Massachusetts. I mean, I'm sure you know of some of it. I think they employed 15,000 people in Pittsfield at one point. I don't think they employ anyone out there. You know, they have had lots of employees up in Lynn working on jet engines. I don't think they have I think they still have a few people, not many there. But just, I mean, tell us, what does it feel like? We read these numbers in the newspaper all the time of numbers of jobs being added, number of jobs being cut, but how does it feel just to be one of those people and to know people who are part of one of those closures?
It's tough. It's because you, like myself, I'm 27 years here. I mean, the last time I applied for a job, I filled out a application. Now I got to learn how to write a resume and actually even do it online. And where would I go? Is there manufacturing's a dying breed? We don't have that around here anymore. Those type of jobs are hard to come by.
Henry Pyres works for GE Energy in Avon, Massachusetts, and he's the president of the United Auto Workers Local 470 there. Henry, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
So the harsh reality of jobs being lost in Avon and the concurrent reality of jobs coming to Boston, it's all part of the bigger picture of GE's business trajectory. Now, back in the day, GE made light bulbs and refrigerators, like this one from a 1952 commercial.
You don't know what you've been missing until you get this wonderful GE combination. We didn't. We didn't have this separate freezer section with a separate door and a freezing system all its own.
We didn't have all this storage space in the door or conveniences like sliding shelves.
GE talks about itself a little differently these days.
One day, machines will be sprayed to be made. And making something stronger will mean making it lighter. One day, factories will work with the cloud.
Joining us now to talk about GE's evolution and what exactly the company does today is Michael Cusimano. He's professor of management and engineering systems at the MIT Sloan School, and he's consulted for GE. Michael Cusimano, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hey, thank you.
We also have Michael Greeley. He's a venture capitalist at Flare Capital Partners in Boston. He's former chairman of the New England Venture Capital Association. Michael, welcome to Radio Boston to you.
Thanks, Scott.
So a lot of people, when they think of GE, they think of that first ad. They think about the company that makes refrigerators and toasters and other appliances. Maybe, Michael Cusimano, let's start with you. Talk about the kind of company that GE used to be and the kinds of products that it was once known for, where it came from.
Well, GE started very much with the electric light bulb, but that just can't stand alone. You need electric power grids. That led GE into motors and different types of materials, different types of power systems and turbines for running power plants. Eventually, they moved into actually owning mines for power sources for nuclear power plants. I mean, so it's really a story of very interesting related diversification. And they used to be at the forefront of high technology. I mean, they used to be the Microsoft and the Google type of company that we talk about.
So, I mean, they started with Thomas Edison. They became like one of the world's biggest conglomerates, right. Fortune number 8 today. But more recently, it seems like it's been trying to de-conglomeratize, if that's a word, and kind of sell off things, right? They used to own GE Capital, and they sold that off. They used to own NBC, as we remember from 30 Rock. They sold that to Comcast. So why are they getting smaller these days?
Well, I think financially they haven't really done much over the past dozen years or so. This is under Jeffrey Immelt. So they've
financially, in terms of like revenues?
Revenues and profits. Revenues have grown a little bit, but profits have been pretty flat. But all of those businesses, you know, they did have a root in history. I mean, GE was a pioneer in television technology. Television is worthless unless you have content. So they moved into radio. They were a co-investor in RCA. So these businesses have a historical root, and all these products, they need financing, loans, leasing, maintenance, insurance, reinsurance. So it's kind of nurturing these related and semi-related areas that led GE into a conglomerate status. And then when you have a conglomerate, the problem is always, how do you make the whole greater than the sum of the parts?
Yeah.
How do you manage them? And they tend to manage it, a company like that, through financial metrics. And that makes it hard to really have entrepreneurs or aggressive people running the businesses for growth.
I think Jack Welch, the former CEO, was famous for like he would fire 10% of the people, the bottom 10% of the employees every year, right? Just to keep everybody else motivated.
Well, his idea was he'd get rid of any business that wasn't number one or number two in its field. So, and he'd give his managers a few years to do it. And he drew three circles and said, you're either in one of these circles or you're out. If you do that systematically, you do end up with a better performing company, but it's hard to really build synergies. It's hard to build, an entity that's cohesive.
Well, Michael Greeley, I mean, you've met GE's current CEO, right, Jeff Immelt?
Yes.
I mean, what kind of leader is he? What's his vision
company? I think he's an exceptional leader, and a lot of what we're seeing is a natural rotation away from capital-intensive, regulatory burdensome businesses like GE Capital. And so, for me, I think Jeff's brilliance is driving other metrics other than maybe growth, but return on invested capital. I was with him in the Fairfield campus, which is an extraordinary facility, but you know, completely from another era, maybe about a year and a half ago. And he said that he wanted his legacy to be, I'm converting a hardware business to a software data business. Mm-hmm. And while that's an interesting soundbite, as you think about the implications of that, they're very profound. And I think actually the steps he's taken are pretty logical from that vision.
I mean, that's sort of in line of the everything as a service model that I feel like a lot of businesses are going
that's
to, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Do you want to explain that a little bit, Michael? Either of the Michaels, Cusumano or Greeley, what does it mean to say everything as a service? Like, what is a jet engine as a service?
Sure. No, I've written about that. I've written about that quite a bit. GE has been into it. Rolls-Royce actually pioneered it, also in aircraft engines. They call it power by the hour. Started it about 20 years ago. They realized that the airlines that were growing fastest were low-cost airlines or Asian airlines. They couldn't afford to buy new aircraft, but they could afford to lease them. So leasing companies were set up. And Rolls-Royce jumped in with, okay, you can't afford to buy a new engine, but we'll sell you a contract for using, and you pay for it as you go. And GE has come in as well. And this is part of where the financing and insurance and reinsurance business comes in. But you can do that with anything. Zipcar is a model of that as well, right? You can't afford to buy a car, don't have space, or don't want a car, but, you know, you rent transportation. So this whole idea of servitizing products, selling the service or the use of the product rather than the product itself, has been a big trend. Software products really kind of started that off with Salesforce.com back in 1999.
But I'm looking at – Scott, I just want to jump here. I'm looking at some numbers. I mean, we've got that GE had $149 billion in total revenue in 2014, or roughly thereabouts. But just $4 billion of that came from software, so it's still a pretty – small part of its overall business.
Yeah, software, but services was, I believe, more than $40 billion of that.
Okay.
And, you know, they're not a software products company, so you don't really see software as a separate line item.
But and services would be some technician who is taking care of that jet engine things need to be
or
fixed.
Or maintenance contracts.
Uh-huh.
And predictive analytics goes into that as well. So that's where the Internet of Things comes in. You put sensors and some smart technology and into your different products, and you can sell a service along with the product, or you can sell the product as a service and bundle maintenance and predictive analytics and repair and everything like that along with it.
And I think what's interesting, given I'm more intimate with our healthcare business. Jeff grew up in the GE health business. A lot of their customer base is now located in Boston. So to some extent, he's getting closer to a center of gravity for the biotech and pharma industry, which is in Cambridge.
And Michael Greeley, talk about, so Jeff Immelt and all the top executives at GE presumably are now in the market for houses in Boston, right? So this is, I mean, it is a personal decision as well as a business decision, right? That we have lives here in Western Connecticut, around Fairfield, Connecticut. I mean, that does seem to be a pretty big function here of let's move all the top executives. What do you think went into that, and what impact is it going to have here in Boston to have them here?
I think if you're trying to reinvent a company's core philosophy, this hardware to software transformation, I think you need to embed your senior executives in that community. Boston is almost second to none, maybe to the Valley, for software engineering talent. And so we talked earlier with Richard, as you add nodes to these networks, they become geometrically more valuable. So as you expose your senior leadership to what goes on in the Seaport District or in Cambridge or throughout Boston, the whole software development ecosystem, I think executives begin to take on a different dialogue. They begin to focus on different core competencies of the company. I think it's going to be spectacular to have them here. And so I think we're all very excited about their move. And recall Jeff went to HBS and he went
Harvard
to Dartmouth.
Business School, yeah.
He has some New England roots ties here. I had a funny conversation with him. He's unfortunately not a Patriots fan. He is a Packers fan.
Oh,
and so
no.
Maybe every 4 years we'll have some interesting GE activities around the Pats and Pitts.
There's always hope to convert him, though.
Yeah.
What are the risks of GE trying to make this transition? I mean, we're talking about quite a major change, a fundamental change in how it defines itself as a business. And, you know, for as long as it doesn't happen, it can go either way. Like, what are the obstacles and the roadblocks to becoming a software company or services company versus a historical industrial company?
Now, it's an enormously distributed company. So the fact that the headquarters is here, I think, drives from the top down these initiatives. But the execution of that will be out in the field around the world. So I know their healthcare business is nearly $20 billion of hardware, sort of imaging equipment, lab equipment.
MRIs, that
MRI.
Sort of thing.
He wants those to become data streams, data assets. But his software business is a relatively modest business, important business, but growing very quickly. That's managed out of Seattle. And so the challenge for that conversion will happen in other geographies. The leadership and the vision will be created here.
Yeah, but again, you have to think more broadly about software. It's not just selling software products.
Is not them, GE, saying they want to be Microsoft.
Right.
It's
putting software into most of their products and combining that with analytics that helps them sell services of different types. So it's really a technology that can diffuse almost all of their businesses.
But you see what I'm asking, Matt? Like, at this point in time, we're talking about this. As an observer, I'm hearing like, oh, well, this major company is just going to make this change. But there have to be some obstacles towards achieving that vision. If you're Jeff Immelt, what are the obstacles that you're primarily concerned about?
So the big risk is the same that every conglomerate has ever faced. And how do you put these pieces together and generate some real synergy, not just paper synergy?
And they have got competitors out there in all of these spaces, right?
They do. They're actually ahead of a bunch of competitors in terms of thinking through the industrial internet, for example. And they've been working on related areas for quite a long time. But still, jumpstarting growth is going to be hard. because these are very different businesses. I mean, they make everything from MRI systems to delivering healthcare services. And so how do you put those pieces together and get something that's greater than the whole? How do you grow faster than the economy? I mean, the original problem that Jack Welch faced was that GE couldn't grow faster than U.S. GMP because they were so diversified, they were like a sampling of all the industries in the United States. So Jack Welch tried to break that by being very selective in the businesses they were in. I think Immelt has continued that philosophy, but he hasn't really broken free of that.
Mm-hmm. I was with some of the senior executives yesterday at the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference, and to talk about the world coming full circle, they have a very big product vision around their light bulbs embedding sensors to manage healthcare issues in the home. Huh. And so all of these themes begin to converge, and Boston is a wonderful geography for the convergence of those industries.
But they face a problem in that Google gives away a lot of those services for free.
Free.
Yeah. Right. There's a lot more, I think, that we're going to be talking about in the coming days of GE coming to Boston. But Michael Cusimano, Professor of Technological Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Management at MIT Sloan School, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Michael Greeley, Venture Capitalist at Flare Capital Partners in Boston. Michael, thanks to you, too.
Thanks, Scott.
There's more of the show coming up in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Scott Kersner. This is Radio Boston.